KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Who's hurt by all this? Our community, all those employees.
President Trump wants agencies to relocate out of Washington to less costly parts of the country. Critics say the administration has other motives. It's Monday, May 26th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead this hour, shakeups at the National Security Council. Dozens of staffers were pushed from their jobs on Friday, and Marco Rubio is trying to do two very big jobs at once.
You can't be Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. They're two very different jobs, and in fact, one is meant to keep an eye on the other.
And could a project that pays ranchers to take pictures of jaguars pave the way for the restoration of jaguars to the U.S.?
This project is trying to change the perspective of ranchers and provide an opportunity for them to live more harmoniously with jaguars.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Today is Memorial Day, when the country remembers the sacrifices of America's service personnel who gave their lives protecting this country. President Trump today visited the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers at Arlington National Cemetery just outside Washington, D.C., remembering the fallen.
This morning we pay tribute to their immortal deeds. We share in the sorrow of their beloved families, and as one nation we give thanks for the ultimate gift they have so selflessly given to all of us.
He also used the occasion to criticize his predecessor, former President Biden, and take credit for bringing the Summer Olympics and the World Cup to the U.S., while also touting his plans for a large military parade in D.C. next month, a celebration of both the Army's 250th anniversary and his 79th birthday. In northwest England, police say four children are among dozens of people injured after a minivan plowed into a crowd as thousands of soccer fans celebrated the Premier League's championship in Liverpool. A man in his 50s has been arrested. NPR's Fatma Al-Kassab reports police say they're not treating the incident as terrorism.
Local police say it started out as a joyous day in the city of Liverpool, where hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets for Liverpool Football Club's victory parade. But as the parade came to an end, they received reports of a car hitting pedestrians in the city. More than two dozen people were taken to hospital with injuries. Police say they have arrested a 53-year-old British man, who they believe to be the driver of the vehicle. They say they believe it to be an isolated incident and are not looking for anyone else. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
Israeli airstrikes Monday across Gaza killed more than 60 people, 31 of them in a school shelter, trapping families inside classrooms that then caught fire. NPR's Anas Baba went to the site of the attack, where 18 of those killed were children. NPR's Ira Batraoui brings us his reporting.
A young girl cries for her mother. She was killed in the blaze of an Israeli airstrike on a school in Gaza City. The school's classrooms had been turned into shelters for families seeking safety from Israeli bombardment in northern Gaza. Israel's military says it struck, quote, key terrorists using the school as cover. It did not respond to NPR's request for more information. At a nearby hospital, Khadija Kiala is left with her three-year-old orphaned niece to raise. The girl's mother was killed in the airstrike. She tells NPR's Anas Baba, "We don't want food or the borders to open. We just want to rest. Kill us in one go so we aren't forced to mourn someone new every month."
NPR's Aya Batraoui reporting. This is NPR News. Saturday Night Live is capping its 50th season with a new exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. From member station WKSU, Kabir Bhatia has more.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
For 50 years, SNL has mixed comedy with cutting-edge music. Now, visitors to the new exhibit can watch every single musical performance in the show's history at the Rock Hall. About 150 inductees have appeared on SNL. But you won't just see Paul Simon, Prince, Taylor Swift, or Bruno Mars. The exhibit also includes props and costumes from musical sketches like More Cowbell, Wayne's World, and the Blues Brothers. The show's longtime music coordinator, the late Hal Wilner, originally suggested the exhibit as a way to get the clips to the public, since they're often tied up with copyright clearances and can't be streamed. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia in Cleveland.
Elon Musk's SpaceX is getting ready to do another test launch of its massive Starship rocket as early as tomorrow. He's hoping that the rocket will one day take people to Mars, but first, it has to get to space. At least two test flights exploded minutes after launching, with debris raining down on the Caribbean. This time, SpaceX says it solved the problem linked to one of the spacecraft's engines. The FAA has cleared SpaceX to launch Starship as many as 25 times a year from Texas and expanded the hazard zone in the event that another spacecraft explodes during launch. That's to reduce the chance of civilian aircraft crossing the path beneath the rocket. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump's efforts to downsize the federal government by cutting thousands of jobs have gotten a lot of attention, but he also wants agencies to relocate from Washington to less costly parts of the country. This is something he tried during his first term, moving the headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management to Colorado. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg reports on how that went.
The desert city of Grand Junction is nearly 2,000 miles from D.C. About 70,000 people under towering red rock cliffs beside the Colorado River. It's surrounded by public land run by the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. Western populists have long complained that decisions about what can and can't be done on federal land are made in faraway Washington. In 2018, Colorado Senators Cory Gardner and Michael Bennett, a Republican and a Democrat, made a promotional video with the city's economic partnership.
You'll not find a better place to locate the BLM headquarters than Grand Junction.
It all comes together here in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Robin Brown ran the economic partnership at the time.
I don't think anyone thought realistically little old Grand Junction would get the BLM headquarters.
She's at Grand Junction's airport, which has six gates.
We have zero nonstop flights to D.C.
But in 2019, Grand Junction got its Cinderella story when President Trump told the BLM to pack up its headquarters and move it here.
It was so exciting, and it was sort of this, like, dream come true, and everything we had worked so hard for came to fruition.
Bringing in high-paying jobs and putting Grand Junction on the map. Great decision, says William Perry Penley, who Trump appointed to run the BLM in 2019.
You want that director of the Bureau of Land Management to be out here because he or she will have firsthand knowledge of what's going on.
Dozens of former BLM officials signed a letter protesting the move, saying the agency needs leaders in D.C. to advocate for public lands in front of lawmakers and the president. Others saw an ulterior motive, to get longtime agency employees in Washington to quit, to either make the agency smaller or to replace them with people more ideologically aligned with President Trump. Penley says moving the agency west brought in fresh blood.
And I asked every one of the final applicants, I said, if this job were advertised in Washington, D.C., would you have bid on it? And every one of them said no.
But of the hundreds of jobs relocated out of Washington, only three employees asked to move to Grand Junction actually did. Shortly after the new headquarters opened, the pandemic mostly shut down in-person work. And the following year, President Biden moved the headquarters back to D.C. But now the debate over moving agencies out of Washington is alive again, literally.
Let's get it done. Thank you.
In Grand Junction, a conservative Colorado think tank pitted William Perry Penley against Mary Jo Rugwell, the BLM's former state director in Wyoming. Rugwell echoes the suspicions of a lot of Western liberals that Trump is trying to break federal land agencies so public lands can be privatized.
If there aren't enough people, and if communication isn't good, and if things don't work well, it's pretty easy for somebody to say, oh, you guys are doing a terrible job. We better do something else with these lands.
Earlier this year, Utah and a dozen other states asked the Supreme Court to give a big chunk of federal land to state governments to manage. It declined. It was a bad idea, says Rugwell. Robin Brown, whose job used to be promoting Grand Junction, says she still thinks this is the best place for the BLM's headquarters, but she's tired of it being a political pawn.
So the idea that now we're going to move the BLM headquarters back is just as disappointing as moving it away, because I just feel like, well, then we wait 4 years till the next Democratic president, and then they'll move it away again. And then, you know, who's hurt by all this? Our community, all those employees.
The BLM did not respond to a question about whether it plans to move its headquarters back to Grand Junction. For NPR News, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
The Trump administration has attempted to cut off funding for a program that provides housing to homeless Americans. Last week, a federal judge extended a ruling barring that action. It's part of a broader effort to slash federal support to democratically led cities with policies the administration disagrees with. Marisa Lagos from member station KQED in San Francisco reports on how vulnerable Americans are caught in the middle.
RJ Sloan says he was living the American dream. He worked for a giant pharmaceutical company and owned two homes. Then came a health crisis.
I had a psychotic break from reality. I left my apartment, lost everything, including my two dogs, and I started running around San Francisco, living in Golden Gate Park, eating out of trash cans.
Sloan, who's now 60, spent several years on the streets before landing a spot at Bishop Swing Community House, a supportive housing development in San Francisco's South of Market District. It's one of 23 sites operated by the nonprofit Episcopal Community Services, housing more than 2,000 people in the Bay Area. When he first moved in, Sloan says, just surviving was a struggle.
My first 5 years here, I wore the same clothes every single day. I never changed my clothes. I rarely showered or brushed my teeth. I was in such a bottomed out phase of life.
Sloan eventually started getting better. He says it wasn't just because he had a safe place to live. It was also the support, mental health services, medical care, and importantly, case managers who encouraged him to continue moving forward when he was ready.
You're encouraged to make your appointments. You're encouraged to keep up with the goals that you set. So I began working part-time as a front desk clerk.
That work at a nearby homeless shelter now helps pay for Sloan's apartment, but the bulk of the rent is paid for by the federal government through a U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development program known as Continuum of Care. It's money that local governments and their nonprofit partners, like Episcopal Community Services, rely on to tackle homelessness, and they're at risk of losing it. In the Bay Area, Santa Clara County receives about $34 million a year from the program. San Francisco gets around $50 million annually. The two Bay Area counties are among dozens of local governments around the nation suing the Trump administration over new grant conditions announced earlier this year. Tony Lopresti is Santa Clara County's chief counsel.
Our ability to really make progress in combating homelessness and making sure that those families have not only shelter, but the services that they need really hinges in large part on our ability to access these federal funds.
Under the new rules, local governments have to certify that they do not have DEI programs, don't promote, quote, gender ideology, unquote, and don't have sanctuary immigration policies. HUD didn't respond to a request for comment, but in a post on X, HUD Secretary Scott Turner defended the shift as a way to push back against what he called a woke agenda. Lopresti says the new conditions are illegal and so vague they're impossible to comply with. Earlier this month, a federal judge sided with the counties, ordering a temporary halt to the new grant conditions, meaning that for now, the grant funding is safe. But that could change in the future. If the counties lose these ongoing legal battles, it'll pose difficult choices for organizations that operate housing developments like the Bishop Swing House in San Francisco.
If it disappeared, then we would certainly be challenged, right, to be able to keep these buildings funded and operating.
That's Beth Stokes, executive director of Episcopal Community Services. She says her organization will try to find funding to help keep Sloan and others in their apartments, but they may have to delay future projects aimed at getting even more homeless people off the streets. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
Former Congressman Charles Rangel has died. A Democrat, he represented a New York City district, including the historically black neighborhood of Harlem, for nearly 50 years. Rangel once joked with voters,
"You know, modesty is not really my best trait."
Charlie Rangel was born in Harlem. He served in the U.S. Army and the Korean War. He returned to New York and was elected to the House of Representatives in 1970. For decades, he served on the House Ways and Means Committee, which shapes tax law. In 2007, he became the first black member to chair that committee.
We have an obligation, whether people are in Mississippi or whether they're in Las Vegas, to help people. I think that if you're old and crippled and poor, we should say, not in our country.
That was Rangel speaking with NPR's Steve Inskeep as he prepared to take on the position. Rangel often worked to shape tax law for his causes, like affordable housing. He was also a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus. In 2008, then-Senator Barack Obama accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for president. Here's what Rangel had to say about that to NPR.
To me, it's the most exciting thing that's happened since the possible exception of the Voting Rights Act. And I've been telling everybody that I marched with Dr. King in the 60s, 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery, and I cussed every step of the way. I said, what a big mistake. What am I doing here? Because I had no idea of the history-making value of that sacrifice, and that Lyndon Johnson would be persuaded to sign the Voting Rights Act. So I tell everyone, don't let that happen to you.
Rangel was also the subject of a 2010 House ethics investigation for his own financial transactions. That year, he was reelected by an overwhelming margin, but he was found guilty of ethics violations and censured by his House colleagues. It cost him his committee chairmanship. Still, he told NPR's Michelle Martin the following year,
"This has been a fascinating experience. It's like an unending a postgraduate course, and to be able to see the changes in your community, the nation, and the world, and to be a part of it, and to be able to change things, it is something that you really can't describe."
Charles Rangel died today. His family confirmed he was 94 years old. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The U.S. needs jaguars. Yes, the jungle cat. They used to roam much of the country, from Southern California to Texas, maybe beyond. Then, around the early 1900s, poaching ramped up. Ranchers feared the cats were preying on cattle, and jaguars were basically hunted out. Enter a project across the border in Mexico that works with ranchers to protect jaguars and might bode well for efforts to restore them to the U.S. Benji Jones went to take a look and wrote about it for Vox. Benji Jones, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why does the U.S. need jaguars? And I guess I'll start by saying I didn't know that they're an American species.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that they're an American species. And you're right, they likely came into the U.S. before making their way down in their evolutionary history to Central and South America. So they truly are a U.S. species. And in terms of why we need jaguars, I mean, we really need these cats for the ecosystems because they play a vital role in the food chain as the top predator. So they help control other species below them, which then control the grass and so forth. So they really are an integral part of the ecosystem.
Huh. Okay, so let me take you across the border, Sonora, Mexico, and this project I mentioned, which launched a few years ago now, back in 2007. What is it called? How does it work?
Yeah, so it's a really innovative project called Viviendo con Felinos, which just means living with felines or cats, wild cats. And so in Sonora, which is the northern Mexico state just below Arizona, there's also this issue where you have ranchers in some cases killing jaguars for their perceived, because they believe that they attacked their calves, and calves are very important to the ranchers because they sell them and that's their livelihood. And so this project is trying to change the perspective of ranchers and provide an opportunity for them to live more harmoniously with jaguars and other wild cats by essentially paying them for the presence of these cats on their ranches.
And it's through photography. Explain that.
Yeah, it's really amazing. So one thing that's interesting about jaguars is that they are really hard to see face to face. They're sort of these like ghosts on the landscape that you just never see. So people who have worked in these regions of Mexico for a very long time never see them face to face. But if you put out motion cameras, so cameras that activate every time something walks by, they will detect these very elusive creatures. And so what this project does is actually put these motion sensing cameras around the ranch, and then those cameras will detect the cats, and every time they detect a new jaguar or a puma, those ranchers will get paid for that detection. So basically, it's creating this incentive to keep these cats on their land.
How much is a picture of a jaguar worth if you are a rancher in Mexico?
Yes. So a picture of a jaguar is worth 5,000 pesos, Mexican pesos each, which is about $260 in today's US dollars. I should say 5,000 Mexican pesos is similar to what someone in Mexico might make for killing a jaguar. So ranchers that think they have a problem with jaguars killing their calves, in the past at least, would pay cowboys to kill jaguars, and they might pay them around $5,000. And that was very deliberate, to try to make this payment of a photo of a live jaguar similar to what you could make for killing them.
Okay, so to the question of how this program might inform what happens with the jaguar population here in the U.S., like, what is the link there?
So we used to have jaguars from Southern California all the way to Texas and maybe even Louisiana, and there's no longer a breeding population of cats in that region. The northernmost breeding population of jaguars in the world is around this reserve, is around these ranches that I was talking about. And so if you want to have jaguars return to the southern U.S. without physically like transporting them, you need a healthy population in Sonora that could naturally migrate north over time. And so the idea is that if you can protect this population in Sonora, figure out how to avoid this retaliatory killing of the cats, you might see a northward migration into the U.S. Then, of course, the question becomes, okay, well, what about the border and the border wall? And that's a whole other problem.
Benji Jones is an environmental correspondent at Vox. Thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thanks so much, Mary Louise.
When you picture a pickup, you might imagine a big truck towering over the rest of traffic, but a new truck has hit the roads of the U.S., and it is not what you are used to, as Casey Martin from KUOW in Seattle reports.
Tonali Gruder runs a flower farm on an island north of Seattle.
On a regular basis, we'd be loading heavy tables and buckets and doing a lot of setup, pop-up tents, all these different things. And it was very, very physical, and it was hard on us.
They used to work out of a Chevy Express van, but it was hard to get in and out of. Then they discovered K-trucks, tiny Japanese pickups that have a small cab but a large bed in the back. Gruder knew they had to get one. And not just any K-truck.
Specifically, the fire trucks come with a lot of racking and sort of accessories built into them that are very suitable to farming.
These are small, often even smaller than a sedan. Not the fastest vehicles. They top out at about 70 miles per hour, but tough and reliable. And they're usually well-maintained by fire departments with very low miles. Many still have their lights, PA systems, and as you can hear, their sirens. Which comes in handy if you slow down traffic.
So we're able to put on our lights as flashers, hop on our intercom, and let people know, you know, thanks for supporting local farms. This vehicle is slow, and we will pull over when we can.
Adam Kovanak is a dealer who buys cars in Japan to import to the U.S. He says he's seen a real uptick in K-trucks on the West Coast in the last 10 years, with cars being sent from Japan to ports in Seattle, San Francisco, and L.A. Several dealers said most of the cars stay on the West Coast, but they've also sold to buyers in Texas and North Carolina. According to Kovanak, you used to be able to pick one up for about $5,000. Today, that's closer to $10,000. But it hasn't curbed demand.
So it's not uncommon for them to have a deposit before they land.
Kovanak says K-trucks first started showing up in the U.S. when large factories, universities, and zoos bought them as utility vehicles. Then they really caught on with Japanese car enthusiasts and drivers wanting a truck with a smaller footprint.
They are really easy to like. They're inexpensive, they're easy to park, they're pretty reliable, pretty durable. You park them for a year, you turn the key, they start right up.
Most of the K-trucks driving around are from the mid to late 90s. That's due to federal restrictions on importing K-trucks less than 25 years old. So they often need new parts and maintenance. That's where Tuan Nguyen can help. He runs a Facebook group where thousands of K-truck fans swap tips and advice. Quinn took me out for a drive recently. I climbed in on the right side where the steering wheel is.
Getting it on this side is so weird.
If you get in an accident on the freeway, you're going to die, so at least it'll be quick.
That Facebook page is where Quinn met Daniel Tan. Tan works in professional racing, so he knows serious car people and car culture. Usually, there's a lot of talk about speed and horsepower. But K-truck owners, he says, are much more lighthearted.
The K-truck community is just like, hey, I painted it like a panda, and it looks like a panda now. It's just a quirky group of people.
They may be popular here in Washington, but in some states, like Oregon, you can't register K-trucks. Oregon's Department of Transportation says they're not built for American highways. They don't even have airbags. Colorado just legalized them, but K-lovers there will have to wait until 2027 to register one. For NPR News, I'm Casey Martin in Seattle.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has targeted Harvard University, ordering thousands of international students to go home or change schools, also canceling grants in a bid to force the university to accept more federal control. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're in Boston to interview Harvard President Alan Garber. You can see it online or hear it tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In her debut novel, author Sarah Hamden's main character is a Palestinian woman who is messy, real, and keeping a secret.
I could think of no better way to talk about cultural stereotypes than through comedy, because it's a wonderful way to be honest, but also to show vulnerability.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. Liverpool, England police say 27 people are hospitalized and a 53-year-old man is in custody after he allegedly drove a minivan into a crowd of soccer fans. They were there to honor the city's Premier League team that had won the 20th top-tier championship. Police say it appears to have been an isolated incident and not an act of terrorism. France's President Emmanuel Macron says he hopes President Trump's anger towards Russia will translate into action. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Macron's reaction came hours after Trump criticized Russian President Putin for the massive air assault on Ukraine, calling him crazy and possibly warning of additional sanctions.
Macron said he hoped Trump's indignation would result in the U.S. coming together with the Europeans for a much bigger sanctions package, one that could, quote, dissuade Russia and finally bring an end to the conflict. Germany's new chancellor, Friedrich Merz, now says that Germany, Britain, and France will no longer impose restrictions on the use of their long-range weapons.
The sweeping spending plan that Republicans are crafting to implement the president's social policy contains vouchers. Here's NPR's Corey Turner.
The government can't directly fund private religious schools, so Republicans in Congress are looking to do it indirectly, using the tax code. A private citizen could make a donation to a nonprofit called a scholarship-granting organization, which would then bundle that money into vouchers for students to attend private schools. What's more, folks who donate would get a generous dollar-for-dollar tax credit, meaning if they give $5,000, they could knock $5,000 off their tax bill. And if donors give stock instead, they can avoid capital gains taxes. By one estimate, the plan would cost the U.S. government more than $23 billion in lost revenue.
NPR's Corey Thompson. Former New York Congressman Charlie Rangel, who represented Harlem in Congress for 46 years and who rose to become the first black member to chair the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, has died. He was 94. Rangel was the co-founder of the Congressional Black Caucus, and he championed empowerment zones and other tax programs designed to help lower-income people. He was also one of the first leaders against apartheid in South Africa. In 2010, he was censured in the House in an ethics scandal, but served until 2017. 16 young people from Montana made headlines last year when they sued the state for failing to act on climate change. They won. Now bills backed by conservative state lawmakers to get around the decision have been signed into law. More from Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin.
Last year, Montana's Supreme Court ruled that the plaintiffs have a fundamental constitutional right to a clean and healthful environment. The court ordered the state to consider climate impacts when approving fossil fuel projects and keep track of their greenhouse gas emissions. The new laws appear to thread the needle of the decision. Montana will now inventory emissions, but it won't regulate them. Olivia Vesevich is one of the plaintiffs.
To watch our legislatures actively dismiss a constitutional ruling is devastating.
Vesevich says the longer the state delays considering climate impacts, the worse the future will look for young people like her.
This is NPR from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's a classic Washington power move, the late-on Friday news dump. Well, this past Friday, at 4:30 p.m., start of a long holiday weekend, about half the staff of the National Security Council got emails asking them to leave by 5 p.m. Dozens of people abruptly dismissed. The restructuring of the NSC, that's how Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio has characterized it, it continues a trend in this second term for President Trump, a trend of radical downsizing. The Trump administration plans to cut thousands of intelligence and national security jobs across the government, the kind of jobs in which Richard Clark served more than three decades, 10 of those years, on the National Security Council. Dick Clark, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
As you have tracked some of these changes over the last few months, I'm curious what has struck you, and I wonder if you would start with the departure of Trump's initial national security advisor, Mike Waltz, and now Secretary of State Rubio stepping in to do that job, as well as being Secretary of State.
Well, I think the president has to have a personal relationship of trust with his national security advisor. And apparently the president didn't have that with Mike Waltz. I think Mike was very well qualified to do the job, but if he didn't have that relationship, then he really couldn't do the job in the best way. So I understand the president asking him to leave. You can't be Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. I know Henry Kissinger did that for a while.
I was about to say, there is precedent. Yeah.
It wasn't a good precedent. They're two very different jobs. And in fact, one is meant to keep an eye on the other. And if you're the same person, that gives you a little bit of a problem. So I hope that doesn't continue.
And then what about this purge over the weekend? Would you use that? Is that the right word?
Well, it's a reduction in staff. I may surprise you by what I'm about to say. I have no problem with reducing the size of the NSC staff significantly, maybe even by half. It had grown over the course of the last two decades. It had grown out of all proportion. The question is really not how many people are on it. The question is, what's its role? And when I heard that Rubio wants to change the role, change it to what? It performs a very essential role. And if you're going to change that, we're going to have problems in national security.
Rubio spoke to this a little bit. These were in a statement to Axios, which was the first news organization to report the firings last week. And Rubio said, and I'm quoting, "The right sizing of the NSC is in line with its original purpose and the president's vision." Dick Clark, speak to that second thing, the president's vision. To what degree is the National Security Council supposed to reflect the president's vision, and to what extent are they supposed to challenge it?
They are his staff. They are to give him options, and they are to keep an eye on the vast national security bureaucracy. You know, the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA won't tell you everything that they're doing. And you need people that you trust on your staff who will keep an eye on them to make sure that they're implementing your directives. But the real job of the NSC is to identify issues that need presidential guidance and then to give the president options and to analyze and compare those options. And what I see not happening in this administration is the analysis part. As far as I can tell, decisions are made.
And I understand you're on the outside now, but do you see them giving him options or do you see them being told, this is the plan, find a way to make it work?
I think it sounds like it's the latter.
What have you seen that causes you to say that?
Well, everything. I mean, they have no economic analysis of the implications of their tariff decisions. They have no analysis of their decisions with regard to Russia. It's all intuitive. It's all gut. It's all his gut. And his gut's frequently wrong because he doesn't have experience in this area. And a good NSC staff It comes up with options and compare all three or four or five options against a set of evaluative criteria that everyone can agree on. If you don't do that, you will regret it because you'll get mush. And I think that's what's happening.
Just to make this concrete, is there an incident, an example you would point me to from your time in government where there was debate, there was back and forth, the NSC came up with a menu of options, presented them, and the president maybe changed his mind?
Well, certainly. When Bill Clinton came into office, he wanted to not invade Haiti, not restore the democratically elected president. He wanted to keep the thousands of Haitian immigrants in various places around the Caribbean. And we pointed out to him over time that that wasn't going to work. And he had to reverse a campaign promise. And he did, because the facts were the facts. But we presented him with the facts and with the analysis.
Hmm. I know that Marco Rubio, in his brief days so far running the NSC and the State Department, he's made the point that foreign policy, that the NSC is redundant in many ways, and that foreign policy should be being conducted out of the State Department, where they already have all these in-house experts. What's wrong with that view?
Well, they're not the only one that have equities. The president has equities. The Treasury Department has equities. The Commerce Department has equities. The Defense Department, the intelligence community. Yeah, the State Department is the lead implementer and should perhaps be the lead in developing an option. But there are a lot of other experts in the government and a lot of other interests that the State Department does not reflect.
Just to read people in on your own history, Richard Clark, you started on George H.W. Bush, National Security Council. Bill Clinton came into office. He asked you to stay on a few months. I believe that became 8 years.
It did.
Yeah. And then the second president, Bush 43, asked you to stay on a few months. That became a couple of years. So, in other words, have the long view on this. With the long view in mind, would you offer any advice to President Trump, to Marco Rubio, as they try to figure this path out?
Well, first, get a national security advisor. Get a full-time national security advisor. Secondly, agree on the role of the NSC. The number of people there is a secondary issue. Agree on the role. And the role ought to be coming up with what issues deserve presidential decision, number one. Number two, giving the president options and comparing them against a consistent set of evaluative criteria. And then three, oversee the implementation, because presidents make the mistake that they think a policy is over when they decide it. No, it's only just begun when you have a presidential decision. The bureaucracy, I know this will surprise you, the bureaucracy will do what it wants over time and will ignore presidential orders.
Richard Clark, who held quite a few jobs, as you just heard, in U.S. government policy roles across decades. He is also the author of several books, most recently, Artificial Intelligentsia. Richard Clark, thanks.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Hawaii, there's an ancient sport that involves a sled and breakneck speed. It is not as well known as surfing, but native Hawaiian cultural practitioners are working to change that. Hawaii Public Radio's Catherine Kluet-Paktal explains.
The tradition of he'e holua is thousands of years old.
Okay, put them right on the line.
These sleds weren't raced on snow, but steep stone courses.
Lying down with your face 6 inches off the stones, flying down a hill.
That's cultural practitioner and educator Mahi LaPierre at a recent holua workshop on the island of Molokai.
Some people say the Hawaiian extreme sport, so people die.
Ancient papaholua, or sleds, were up to 18 feet long and just 6 inches wide. They were raced on tracks stretching a mile from the mountains down to the ocean. The goal was distance, speed, and survival. Pohaku Stone has been researching and riding Holua for more than 3 decades. He says historically, to start the ride, you'd run while carrying the Papa Holua and throw yourself over a wall onto the main track.
You're holding that sled that's 50 pounds or more, and you're casting it forward out in front of you as you leap over this wall.
Once you picked up speed, you'd hurtle head first down the track as fast as 80 miles an hour. Today, Holua are usually ridden on steep, grassy slopes, or whatever hill you can find, like at the workshop. Stone says early Hawaiian legends describe volcano goddess Pele riding Holua down the lava fields, and the sport honors her. Tracks were found across Hawaii. But in the 1800s, with the influence of Christian missionaries, he says Holua was banned, along with other cultural practices.
Most of those slides were systematically destroyed. There was a great movement to erase that completely.
Stone has been instrumental in piecing together what we know of Holua today from written accounts, oral histories, and archaeological research. He's led an effort to rekindle the sport. Mahi LaPierre and Iliahi Du are also working towards that goal. The two of them recently led the 3-day workshop on Molokai. Participants built 7-foot-long Papa Holua. Du says he hopes Holua will once again be commonly practiced in Hawaii.
That's what our intention is to make it normal, you know, because it's such a lost art.
At the workshop, Molokai participants from youth to elders used hand tools to sand the rough-cut native ohia hardwood.
Just feel, yeah? See, you're instantly doing something already.
After the wood is smooth as glass, its color darkens and shines with coconut oil to help the sleds glide. Then the pieces are lashed together. For LaPierre, it's a sacred process.
2 days ago, we just had wood. Now we have a vehicle to ride in the footsteps of our ancestors.
Kanoi Lani Davis hosted the workshop through her nonprofit Ho'aka Mana. One of their goals is fostering well-being through Native Hawaiian traditions.
The health of our cultural practices and disciplines is the health of our people.
She says participants loved the event and want to get together again to ride Holua. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Kluwit-Paktal on Molokai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Mia Elmas lives a double life. She works as a fact checker for a news publication by day and as a stand-up comedian by night. And then one day, she discovers her Palestinian grandmother's diary dating back to the 1940s in what was then Jaffa, only to learn that her grandmother, decades before, also kept a secret from her family, a forbidden love. How Mia and her grandmother disclose their mutual secrets to each other forms the storyline of the new novel by Sarah Hamden called What Will People Think? It's a book that reckons with how the pursuit of passion can collide with a family's love and the consequences of being forced to choose. Sarah Hamden joins us now. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you, Sarah. Well, I want to just begin by saying it is refreshing to see a book that it's about Palestinian women, but it's a book that's not primarily about religion or politics or regional conflict. And I was wondering, how intentional was that choice to make this a story more about love and family and comedy?
It's exactly that. I mean, this is the message that I wanted to put out from day one, and especially for an Arab woman, and especially so even now more than ever, perhaps, for someone of Palestinian heritage, because it's a very misunderstood, politicized identity. And I just wanted to see if it was possible to write a really great story that happened to feature a Palestinian woman who is American and messy and funny and real and not just reduced to these headlines and just centered around joy, because we're not monoliths.
It is so fun to see an Arab woman, particularly a Palestinian woman, who is not a stereotype, right? Like, why did you choose to make Mia a New York City comedian specifically?
I could think of no better way to talk about cultural stereotypes than through comedy, because it's a wonderful way to be honest, but also to show vulnerability. And comedians, they just stand up on stage and they bare their souls and they make people laugh by sharing these little insecurities, and they want to feel seen, literally seen and understood. And I just thought that this was a beautiful way to tell the story.
Well, Mia, she has to keep her comedian life a secret to protect her family, and we won't get into why that is right here. But decades before her, her grandmother, Zaina, also pursued a forbidden passion that placed her family at risk. And it made me wonder, you know, these two women, they're connected at that level. What is it that you wanted to show about the trade-offs of a family's love?
So I think this is such a beautiful question, because this book really does tackle different forms of love. So you have platonic love with Mia's friendship with Katie, her coworker. You have the forbidden crush that Mia has on her boss at work. And then you have the Zaina story, who's her grandmother, and this illicit affair she has with a British soldier. And all of this behind the family expectations of you're supposed to marry the right kind of guy. And I think part of this is coming of age for both of them. It's just showing that at any age, you can find the right love that's meant for you. So I think my approach was just to show a very layered look at the different ways that we fall in love and how our own family expectations play into that.
What do you hope people will reflect on when they think about love after reading your novel? Because we've talked about so many different kinds of love, the love of friendship, the love in romantic love, a family's love. What is it about love that you want people to take away?
I think real love builds bridges, and it's just a way of connecting. And this is what life is about. It's just experiencing joy. And I do say that with the full acknowledgement that the last couple of years has been so heartbreaking, not just for me as someone of Palestinian heritage, but just as a mother, as a journalist, on so many levels. What's happening in the Middle East and Palestine is devastating. And literature has a quiet but powerful role here, because it reminds us of people's humanity. And this is what I've tried really hard to do in this novel.
Sarah Hamden's new book is called What Will People Think? Congratulations on your debut novel, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for this honor. It's been wonderful speaking to you.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Tulika Prasad. Her son, Vedant, is nonverbal and autistic. One day in September 2016, Vedant was struggling. He'd just found out that his school could no longer serve him. And a few days earlier, his speech therapist had also decided that she wasn't the right person to support him. But life had to go on, so that afternoon, Prasad and her son went to the grocery store.
While we were out in the checkout lane, my son suddenly grabbed my hair. You know, if he grabs your hair, it's literally impossible to undo it. And he was pulling my hair in all directions, and I was wincing in pain. And I could literally feel all eyes on us, as you would expect in a situation like this. But there was this one person, this lady ahead of us in the checkout lane, who turned around, looked at us very gently, and asked me if she could unload my cart, just help me out a bit. And I nodded. I was still struggling with my son. So finally, my son calmed down, left my hair, and let me go. I moved ahead to make the payment for my purchase. And the cashier said that the lady who had unloaded my cart had also made the payment. So I went and said, thank you. And then I offered to pay her, but she firmly refused. She said, I have a child with autism, I understand. And then she offered me to walk me to my car. I was kind of hesitant, but then I agreed. Something about that lady, I wanted to be by her side a little longer. So as we walked, she was quiet. She didn't say a single word. And there was a healing in that silence. She did not sympathize with me or show me pity. She offered her empathy, and that made me feel better. As a parent of a child with special needs, everybody's telling me what to do and what not to do so that my son can be quote-unquote corrected or cured. So when she came to help me, I did not want that additional piece of advice like don't go out with your son or you should be more careful or, you know, things like that. So I just needed someone to shield me from everyone's gaze. And that's what she did. So it mattered a lot.
Chulika Prasad and her son Vedant live in Cincinnati, Ohio. Today, Vedant is a 10th grader at a school for students with developmental disabilities where he is learning to use technologies to help him communicate. Vedant tells us he enjoys long car rides and taking walks with his dad. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And whistle and blow your blues away.